Well, I'm sorry for all of those who came this morning to hear Lee present material, but as I said, he's been a little otherwise occupied, and today you have to endure a little bit of pain. In the 5th century, King Angus was being baptized by the man known as Patrick. And during the course of the baptism, I don't know exactly how this happened, but Patrick carried a long staff with a very sharp pointed end, and somehow or other, that pointed end came in contact with King Angus's foot and actually pierced it. And after the baptism was over, Patrick looked down and saw this large puddle of blood around King Angus's foot. And he said, "Why did you suffer this pain in silence?" And his response was, "I thought it was part of the ritual." Most people don't react that way to pain. They do anything they can to avoid it. Most people view pain in a negative way. If you've ever had any pain, you know it very well. I wouldn't wish this on anyone, and I've never had it happen to me, but I've heard of people who go to the dentist and he says, "You're going to need a root canal." Imagine these words. He says, "Now, you're going to come back in a week. I want you to do this antibiotic for about a week, and then come back. I'll give you a root canal." And he says, "I know what you've heard about root canals. You've heard they're terrible, that they hurt, but that's not true. The truth is, it's the most gruesome pain known to man. You're going to hurt like you've never hurt in your life. It'll probably be 3 months before you get over it, if you even recover. So just go home and have a nice waiting period, and I'll see you in a week." We have a way of talking about something that gives us anguish, mental pain. And that person I would submit to you who believe such a dentist, probably be getting another dentist or go to someone just to jerk the thing out. But he would be in mental anguish before the actual physical pain was inflicted. There's such a thing as being tormented before the time, as the demons were when they came to Jesus and said, "Have you come here to torment us before the time to send us down to where we're supposed to go?" They're already in mental anguish before the actual, whatever other pain they're going to receive, has been inflicted. And that's a very possible thing for all of us. So pain can affect us in every area of our existence. We usually try to escape it, or if we can't do that, we try to relieve it, and better yet, we try to avoid it altogether. I've read that the number one, the most common reason for Americans going to a doctor in the United States is either to cure the pain, or failing in that, to manage the pain. That's the number one cause of going to the doctor. We have many advertisements in our day offering us analgesics. The A-N on this word is the same as U-N, like the un-cola means it's not a cola. The analgesic, the un-algesic, that's the word that means pain. So it's an un-painer. You take pain relievers. And those are big sellers in our country. People will buy these as they have to. And I've said for a long time, if you hurt enough, you'll take whatever you have to take to get relief. I suspect some of you are very familiar with that. Now, pain is a real thing. I had a philosophy course in school, and I'm ashamed to say I don't remember anything about that course except for one little poem I had to learn. There was a faith healer from Deal who said, "Although pain is not real, when I sit on a pin and it punctures my skin, I dislike what I fancy I feel." I know this is not painful, but I don't like what I'm really not feeling. Pain is a real thing, and it doesn't take a faith healer from Dill to persuade us otherwise. In Genesis 3, verse 16, the first time the word pain occurs in Scripture, occurs in connection with childbirth. I didn't purposely plan this to coordinate with what we've just known about, but it fit that way. In Genesis 3, as God is speaking to the woman and her role in the fall, he said, "I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children." And he goes on to mention a couple of other things. Now, in 1 Chronicles chapter 4, I've always been intrigued by the names people have been given in Scripture. Like, for example, the name Nabal. What mother would name her son Nabal? Fool. Giving him something to live down to. Well, here is Jabez. And I don't know what particular problems he might have caused her when she bore him, but it stuck, and she named him. The consonants for Jabez are the same as the consonants in the word for pain. So she's basically named her son Jabez, my pain child. In verse 9 of 1 Chronicles 4, now Jabez was more honorable than his brothers, and his mother called his name Jabez. You may have a footnote there that says he will cause pain, saying, because I bore him in pain. That reminds you of Genesis 3. That's what God said would happen. And everybody who said his name would remember Genesis 3, our whatever degree you say, ancestor Eve, that's what she has brought upon the world, and that's what we are going through. There's pain in the world. Verse 10, Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, that your hand would be with me, and that you would keep me from evil, that I may not cause pain. I don't want to live down to my name. I've caused pain to my mother upon being born. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't intend to. But I don't want to intentionally cause pain for anyone. So God granted him what he requested, showing us the power of prayer. In 2 Kings 1, accidents happen. And because of this, there are people who suffer and they go through very difficult times. You have Steve talking about someone at work who was killed with an accident this past Thursday night. Here in 2 Kings 1, Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. Now Ahaziah, this is the son of Ahab, fell through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and was injured. So things that happen today, they've always happened. If you build a structure with a second or third story, the possibilities are that someone could fall. And if you fall, you're going to know what pain is. So pain has always been around a variety of ways. And what I've always emphasized here is the fact that he sends messengers. He has to go right by where the prophet is and where the tabernacle is to go down to Philistia to inquire of the Philistine God, as if to say, we're going to snub the God of Israel. And the captain came with his 50 after Elijah sent him back and said, tell the king he's going to die. He sent his man with 50. And he says, the king says, come down. And he says, well, I'll show you what will come down. The fire came down, devoured them. He's the king. He's a slow learner. He said, he sends another king, another captain with his 50. He says, the king says, come down quickly. And I'll show you what can come down quickly. The fire comes down, devours them. The third one has more sense. The king still doesn't get it. He sends a third group, and they say, the king wants you to come, but please don't kill us like you did the others. And so he learns, God says, go with him, and so he does. And the interesting thing in verse 16, the last part of verse 16, therefore you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. So Ahaz died according to the word of the Lord, which Elijah had spoken because he had no son. Jehoram became king in his place. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10, you see an illustration about things that can happen that are unplanned. Ecclesiastes 10, you'll notice at verse 8, he who digs a pit will fall into it. I had a distant cousin in Murfreesboro a few years ago, pretty close to Thanksgiving time of the year, who was in a pit they had dug in excavation work, and the thing collapsed during heavy rain, and he was killed very quickly. You get into a pit, bad things can happen. Accidents can occur. Whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. These walls, many times they have rocks put upon rocks, as I see some of you have in this part of the country. We certainly do. And you're taking that wall apart, a rock at a time, and snakes like to lodge in there sometimes. And you reach in, and the viper grabs you and inserts his teeth, and you're going to hurt if you not die. Verse 9, he who quarries stones may be hurt by them. Everything has its risk. Stones are heavy. They can drop on your foot or do something harmful to you. He who splits wood may be endangered by it. If you have a dull axe, you can swing extra hard, And many times I've missed my leg by about an inch. But the axe can go into your shin very easily. And he says, if the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength, but wisdom brings success. It's not enough just to do something. Act wisely. If you don't act wisely, you're increasing the possibility of pain and accidents. Back in 2 Kings chapter 8, there is a statement that rings all too true for us in these days of terrorism. There's always been terrorism. There's always been evil in the world since Genesis 3. And there's always been people around who are wanting to do things to harm other people if it will benefit them, they think, in some way. In 2 Kings 8, verse 7, Elisha goes to Damascus. Ben-Hadad was sick. And he knew that the man of God had come here. So he told Hazael, his servant, take a present and go see the man of God to inquire of the Lord. Now, I find it interesting. Here's a pagan king who places more stock in Elisha the prophet than Ahaziah the son of Ahab did in the prophet of God. That's quite a story in itself. But in verse 9, so Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him of every good thing of Damascus. 40 camel loads. He said, I really want to know if I'm going to recover. And he stood before him and he said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you saying, shall I recover from this disease? Elisha said, go say to him, you shall certainly recover. However, the Lord has shown me that he will really die. And then he, this first he is Elisha, set his countenance in a stare until he, Hazael, was ashamed. And the man of God wept. Here's a man of God, a prophet. He knows the future. Hazael has his plan in his mind. And he knows with this man staring at him, he's reading his mind by the power of God. And in verse 12, Hazael said, why is my Lord weeping? He says, because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire. And their young men you will kill with the sword. And you will dash their children. You saw this in World War II and occupied areas where many times the evil folks who had no regard for human life would take a small infant by his legs and insert a leg here and a leg here and swing them against the wall and crack their skulls to kill them. It was awful. He says, you will dash their children. Very common thing in war. You will rip open their women with child. Pregnant women, they would just cut them open so both she and the child would die. Hazael said, but what is your servant? A dog that he should do this gross thing? And Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you will become king over Syria. So he goes back and he tells the king, he said, you would survive. And he takes his moss pillow and puts it over his face and smothers him. He becomes the king and he does everything Elisha says. Today we hear about ISIS and Hamas, and all kinds of terror, Al-Qaeda, various types of terror units, especially ISIS, that people talk about the cruelty of these people. They have no regard for human life. They have no regard for faith. They will crucify children. They will cut children in two. They'll laugh as they die and bleed to death. No regard for human life. No regard for anything that's good and decent. And while I would not minimize that for a moment, I want us all to realize that is not really anything new. Hazael, years ago, was doing exactly this same kind of thing. We see it pictured on our TV screens and on our iPhones and whatever else eyes we have. And it's brought to us in real life, but they many times experience this. You see, disease as a problem sometimes that causes pain. We speak of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, in 2 Chronicles 21. And we're told that in verse 16, the spirit of the Philistines and the Arabians had been stirred up by the Lord against him. And in verse 17, there was not a son left to him, except Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. Then verse 18, after all this, the Lord struck him in his intestines with an incurable disease. Now, today we would say it sounds a little bit like colorectal cancer or something like that. But it, whatever it was, it doesn't have to be that. The Lord is quite talented when he wants to punish someone who is very much deserving of punishment. And so in verse 19, then it happened in the course of time after the end of 2 years. Now, I take this to be, he's suffering this intestinal problem for 2 years. That's pain. That his intestines came out because of his sickness. So he died in severe pain. And his people made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. He just wasn't worthy of the honor. So, you see, childbirth, accidents, cruelty, disease, sin itself is oftentimes the source of much pain and suffering. This, Jeremiah 51, is referring to the destruction of Babylon. Babylon, who had inflicted so much pain on her captives, though they hadn't risen to the level of the Assyrians, but they had done their part, says this in 51 verse 8. Babylon has suddenly fallen and been destroyed. Well for her. Put on your mourning garb and cry as if at a funeral. Take balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. And he's speaking in irony. When God afflicts, there's not going to be a cure unless God relieves it, and he's not going to. Balm or balsam was produced from a tree. It's about 10 to 15 high. It's a thorny kind of tree. And they would take the resin from it and make this aromatic gum and use it to soothe and to heal. It would promote soothing and healing. Kind of like aloe vera today is done. Some of you probably use aloe vera plants or something with aloe vera in it. This was very similar to that. Many times expressions used, is there no balm in Gilead? That was a place where these trees typically grew. Or the reason my people are suffering so much is because there's no medicine for them? No, the medicine's there. God had given them what they needed. The problem is they're not listening to it. They're not taking the medicine. They're not going to the drugstore and getting their analgesic. And there was no analgesic for Babylon. And then in Hebrews 12, verse 11, one of the most well-known passages to any father, I believe, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. You have to spank a child. That's not a pleasant situation for you, and it's certainly not pleasant for the child, so why do it? Just why bother? He says, but it's grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. You're doing it for the end result. You're looking ahead. The present pain can cause proper results in character, changes in character that has to take place. Our expression typically is no pain, no gain. If you're not willing to work hard enough to achieve your goal to the point that you're experiencing some pain, chances are you're not working hard enough to achieve the great success you could have achieved. Now, let's talk about three things with reference to pain. Why do we suffer? Somebody says, well, I'd like to know that for sure. Well, we suffer partly because God has given us the freedom to choose. If we have the ability to choose, we may choose something that's wrong. That's what Eve does in Genesis 3. I don't mean to beat this horse to a pulp, but we've talked about Genesis 3 quite a few times already. When Eve sees that fruit and desires it, that violated the law of God, and she could no longer remain. She takes the same fruit, gives it to her husband, and he can no longer remain, and so they're kicked out of house and home. And the thorns come, and the pain comes, and the world is a changed place because man chose not to follow God. And frankly, if they hadn't done it, I would have. Because at some point in my life, when I reached the age of accountability, I sinned. And if I hadn't been around, you would have done it because you also chose to follow the same course they did. So you can't blame them totally when we have done exactly the same thing. We've made the same choices. We're standing on their shoulders no better. We're less excusable than they are. So we talk about choices all the time. I'll mention my cousin who would waddle back and forth, wander back and forth, sway back and forth as he goes to the store to buy more alcohol. And he dies young because of a choice he made early on in life. This same person may get in a car and drive while he's under the influence and consequently hit a tree and be killed or suffer serious injuries. You can make choices that are deadly. We have the freedom to choose. Now, the only other thing that's possible is if we didn't have freedom to choose, God could have made us robots. But we have children who have the freedom to choose. We didn't go buy a robot. We chose to have children, didn't we? Because we want love to be reciprocated, and a robot simply cannot fill that order. God wanted the same thing, and He wanted to save us when we made these errors, but that's another point. Second, we suffer because other people have freedom to choose. In Luke chapter 13, the people who approached Jesus on this occasion appear to be a little shocked. Or, if they're not shocked, maybe they're trying to make a point that, I'm sure glad I'm not like those folks. This hasn't happened to me. I'm a notch above these people. Maybe that's it. I don't know exactly their motives. But Luke 13, 1, there were present at that time some who told Him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Pilate was a cruel, ambitious man, determined to obey the emperor of Rome, and determined to put down any kind of rebellion. He's going to squelch it with the sword and with the power he has as governor. And he's going to show these Canaanites, these Israelites, a thing or two. So while they're sacrificing, he sends his men in and they cut them to pieces so that their blood from their body mingles with the blood of the sacrifices they're offering. They're telling Jesus this. And he surprises them, I suppose. He said, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered such things? Now think about it. What are these men doing as they're killed? They're offering sacrifices to God. It'd be kind of hard to say those are the sorriest people in the country, wouldn't you think? I can think of sorrier people around. Maybe some of those robbers who beat people and leave them half dead. I'd say they'd be more likely to deserve this than these. Surely these aren't the worst, and that's Jesus' point. And he draws this inference from it. I tell you, no, these weren't the worst sinners around. This didn't happen to them because of something they chose. It's something someone else imposed upon them. Pilate inflicted this upon them. But he says, unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. We suffer sometimes because other people can choose. Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, you get his name, dictator after dictator, chose in a greedy fashion to get more and more and more and led people into war, and millions died because of this. You see, ISIS suffering, causing people to suffer because of choices they make. The alcoholic father may get into a car and have a wreck driving under the influence, and he walks away while his children are killed or maybe maimed for life, or they break their necks and are permanently paralyzed. Who knows? Or maybe kill someone else. You have an armed robber who comes in, and because of his selfishness, he's willing to shoot you, maybe make you a paraplegic for the rest of your life, while he gets away with the money and he's out in a few years. Other people have the freedom to choose, and sometimes we suffer because of that. It can't be any other way if God is going to give us freedom to choose. And then third, we may just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. This also happens. Again, in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11, you have here five feats, but you have two factors that limit it, time and chance. I returned and saw under the sun that, number one, the race is not to the swift. Some of you will remember from years ago the name Mary Decker, who was supposed to win, I forgot what race now it was. Well, someone stepped in front of her and she hit her heel and went out and she was done for immediately. But the one who was the fastest runner didn't win the race. That's what he's saying here. The race is not always to the swift. Nor the battle to the strong. Many a time, Alexander the Great would go against people of Persia who had large numbers of people, far more than he had. But because he had brilliance of command, he invented the oblique maneuver and things of this nature, he was able to attack the king directly and do things no other person had done. And they would be off running away while he and his smaller numbers would triumph. The numbers don't automatically tell the whole story, do they? The battle's not always to the strong, nor bread to the wise. You can be a very brilliant person and starve to death. Nor riches to men of understanding. How many times have we talked about poets, about artists who die unknown and barely able to eke out an existence, and it's not until 200 years later their work produces a fortune. Well, is that any comfort to them where they are now? No. And he says, in our favor to men of skill, you can be a very skilled person and get no recognition for what you do. You're not in the right place at the right time. Someone else was. But he says, time and chance happen to them all. We typically call this Murphy's Law, don't we? Murphy's Law is at work with me much of the time. But don't count on immediate visible results. You may not get what you're looking for. You can work diligently. You can have the skill. You can have the knowledge and still not accomplish what you expect. So he says, this happens to them all. For man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net. This fish is swimming along. Oh, what a great day. The water's clear and I'm enjoying myself. Next thing you know, he's whooped up and he's in a net and somebody's going to fry him in a frying pan. Like birds caught in a snare. Oh, look at that luscious food. And next thing you know, he becomes the food. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sometimes that happens. The nature of the universe explains part of this. There's law and order. This is a law of system. So there are actions and consequences. If I want to amuse my grandchildren by running headlong into a tree as fast as I can, that tree is not going to turn to whipped cream just in time to save me from my foolish decision, is it? It doesn't work that way. The universe is not made like that. If I run headlong into a tree, I won't be running anymore, probably permanently. That's the nature of the universe. In chapter 11, verses 3 and 4. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. Some water seems wasted, doesn't it? It just goes here and there and everywhere, more than we need at times. And he says, if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall lie. You say, well, I wish I could undo that one. I wish I could make that tree come back up and let it fall this way. Instead of falling on my car, it would fall in an empty spot. And you say, he who observes the wind will not sow. He who regards the clouds will not reap. Our duty is to just do our duty, not worry about the consequences, and let those come as they may. Fire is a very good thing. Keeps us warm, cooks our food, but fire. As you look at the houses in California, when the fire swept through at 55 miles an hour, can take everything you own in a matter of 3 or 4 minutes. The same fire that saves can kill. Rain is a very good thing. You can have so much rain, you're carried away in a flood. Wasn't the Johnstown flood? You remember hearing about that? Pennsylvania, wasn't it? You can correct me about any of this if I'm wrong. But people died because of too much water and a dam that broke. Eating is a good thing. But a person can eat the wrong things and destroy his health. Esau, for one little decision, changed his entire life. He comes in from hunting. Give me some of that pottage there. He says, well, Jacob says, if you'll give me your birthright, I will. He says, well, I'm about to die. You know how teenagers talk. He wasn't a teenager, but he's talking like one. Haven't eaten in 15 minutes, I'm about to starve. He says, okay, it's yours. And what does Hebrews 12:16-17 tell us about him? He could find no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. All of his tears wouldn't change it. The tree has fallen, it's gone. The young girl loses her purity, it'll never be any other way. There can be forgiveness, but there can be consequences too. David could be forgiven of his great crimes, but he could never erase the consequences and he couldn't keep them from falling upon his children. Now, we want to raise the question, is all suffering evil? What a question. Painful admissions. Parental discipline can lead to right behavior in children. That's evident. The scriptures tell us, we see it by observation, a child acting up. He receives a little bit of a tanning, and the next thing you know, he's a perfect little angel, at least for a while. So we see it by observation. Now, is anybody prepared to say this pain is evil? Was that an evil thing? The child may say, well, do I get a vote? No, you really don't. Because someday, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to say, Mom and Dad, now I understand. But you don't at the time. That's why you have parents. godly parents. So, is this pain evil? Well, obviously not. In fact, let's go a little further. Bodily pain saves lives. Bodily pain can actually save lives. A person starts getting a pain down in his lower right quadrant. Oh, it hurts. And he gets to the point where he's not going to go anywhere, but his wife says, "You're going to the doctor." And so he goes to the emergency room, and they bang on his toe, and they give him the blood test to see if his white count is up, all this kind of stuff. And finally, they say, "You know, you have an appendix issue. We need to take that out." What if that pain hadn't warned him and the appendix had just gone and ruptured and he still didn't feel anything and he just flooded his system with all kinds of poisons and the next thing you know, he's dead? Pain's a good thing, isn't it? He will thank God the rest of his life that he was given pain or else he would be dead. We want pain to occur. Person feels chest pain. He feels it go down his arm. He feels it go down his neck. He starts feeling in his back. It's real tight. And he thinks, this doesn't feel right. He's short of breath. Beads of sweat pop out on him. He just, I think I'm either having a heart attack or ate too much hot chili. One, I'm not sure. And so he goes and they say, "Yes, you're having a heart attack. It's a good thing you came in." Why did he come in? Because of pain. Pain saved his life. Pain can do the same thing for the soul it does for the life. Our purpose in life is to become as God-like as we possibly can. Our purpose is to give Him glory. We are set as trophies of God in eternity so that He can say, "Look what my grace has done." And this is partly what Matthew 5 is telling us about when Jesus is summarizing this first part of this Sermon on the Mount. "Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." You shall be perfect as your Father in heaven. That seems like kind of a high standard, doesn't it? But it can't be any other way. What's he going to say? Well, be partly perfect, but you don't have to take all of it seriously. Well, that's an open check, a blank check to do whatever you please, isn't it? Here's a person who says, "Well, I love God with all my heart. I love His people with all my heart. I also treat my family right, and I work at my job, and I'm a good citizen." And in every area of his life, it's like a pie with all the pieces there, except there's one little slice that's missing. He hates his enemies. You ever make him your enemy? He will never forgive you. All right, that's not a perfect pie, is it? Perfect means complete. He won't be like his God. He won't be perfect like his Father unless, like the Father who causes his Son to shine on the good and the evil. Those evil take his name in vain every day. He makes his Son shine on them. He lets his Son shine on the good and the evil. He lets his rain fall on the good and the bad. Not just the good, but also the bad. They benefit from God's blessings too. God blesses even those who curse Him. If I want to be like my God, if I'm going to be perfect, if I'm going to be complete, I have to add that slice of the pie. That's what he's saying. So I'm to be as God-like as possible. If blessings distract us from this goal, they're bad. Now, I know that's not what you wanted to hear. I frankly don't like it either, but it's true. If my blessings cause me to focus so much on all that I have, how am I different from that rich man in Luke 12 who thought he had heaven on earth? The more inclined we are to think we have it all right here, we don't think about getting it all right there. Pretty simple, isn't it? This man thought, "I have many years, many goods, I'm going to eat, drink, and be married." What about caring for the poor? What about serving your God? What about going to the synagogue? All this. No, never enters his mind. It's all about me. So he uses those pronouns, "I and me," all through that text. Many years, many goods. God says, "No, this night your soul's required of you." Then who will those things be? His ancestors, his descendants will get it to fight over it, and they will. But he's going to be in torment. You'll notice in Mark 4, when Jesus is giving the explanation about thorny soil, that's verse 18, verse 19, he says, "The cares of this world," now they've heard the word, they had the same privilege as everybody else. But verse 19, "The cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things, entering in, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. Nothing wrong with sports. But if sports dominate my life to the point I don't have time to study God's word, I don't have time to assemble with the saints, I live for the Super Bowl, I lose my soul. That's exactly what these folks have had happening to them. They received the word, but other things keep growing up and crowding out the influence of the word, so it's as if they never even heard. Back in 1709, they had the flintlock rifle. And the hammer would come down and strike the flint and cause a spark to make the pan explode and shoot the ball out the muzzle, out the barrel. Sometimes it would just cause a flash in the pan and the bullet wouldn't go anywhere. And so the expression, flash in the pan, was invented. A flash in the pan comes from that use of the flintlock rifle. Well, here are these people, they gladly received what the word says. But it's all a show. It's all a flash. There's no substance to it. There's no real effect in their lives because everything else is drowning it out. That's what he's warning about. All of these blessings that can be so good and we can use them in the service of God and thank God for them, they become a selfish means of just doing what I want to do. Luke 9 gives another illustration of this same disease. Luke 9, verse 57, beginning. It happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. Back in our part of the country, now I'm going to bring up a touchy subject, the Civil War. I wasn't for the South. I didn't fight for the South, so don't hang me in effigy or anything. The South shouldn't have done a lot of things they did. I know that. But the North didn't do for all the right things either. But that's another topic. These young men saw the parades. They saw the uniforms. And the pretty girls, even in Murfreesboro where I live, the pretty girls and others would invite these young men, hey, come over, stand next to me and hear these men talk. They were asked to do this. They got a number of recruits. And the politicians would get up and speak and they'd say, after 6 weeks, at the most 6 months, the war will be over. We'll whip the North and we'll go on our way. And you'll come back and march in a victory parade in this very town, on this very street. Oh, it'll be glorious. It's all about parades and uniforms and flashing guns and pretty girls. Well, they found out that it was about death and starvation and dying and memories they would never get over and being maimed for the rest of their lives. Many of them were deserting in droves from Chattanooga near the end of the war, and on we could go with that. But the parades advertised one thing, the reality was something else. That's what this man's doing with Jesus. He's watched his miracles. He's heard him teach. Nobody could teach like Jesus. I imagine their spines were hard at work as the goosebumps. I've never heard anything like this. This man can speak. He can hold an audience spellbound. I want to follow him like these other disciples. This was the bandwagon to jump on. Lord, I'll follow you wherever you go. And here's what Jesus said to him. Foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests. But the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You better count the cost if you're going to follow me. You may be homeless. You may be run out of one city after another, asked Paul. And you are going to suffer. You will carry a cross if you follow me. And then in Luke 12, verse 15, preceding the statement about the rich man, because he's the way to illustrate what Jesus has in mind here. Luke 12, 15, this man says, Lord, I've heard everything you've said, and I have a very important question for you. Would you talk to my brother and make sure he'll divide the inheritance with me? Talk about a detached listener. Here's one. So in verse 15, Jesus addresses the whole audience and lets his men listen in on it. Take heed and beware of covetousness, that greed for more and more things, like the thorny soil. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. If we multiply blessings, and in this country it's very easy to do, if you use those for good, that's one thing. But if they distract you from the goal of becoming like God, they are your enemy, your worst enemy. If pain brings us closer to God, it's good. I don't mean that pain itself is good, but it produces good results. Psalm 119:67. The psalmist said, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray." Remember the little child before the spanking? He's doing what he pleases. That's what he's saying. Grown-ups are like that too. And he says, "But now I keep your word. Lord, I've learned my lesson." And then in verse 71, "It is good for me that I've been afflicted." What? All right, how many of you believe it's good for me that I've been afflicted? Really? Why does he say this? Not because he likes pain. Not because affliction itself is good. "That I may learn your statutes." Nothing will get your attention like pain. And so, you look at Joseph, who is sold by his brothers. We could stop there and say, what a tragedy. What a painful circumstance. He goes down and becomes a slave for Potiphar. Another painful circumstance. And it is like the cork. You push it down, he just keeps coming back up. His faith in God is holding him on the steady course. And then he's attacked promiscuously by Mrs. Potiphar. He does the right thing. He runs from her. She tells the lie. He suffers for doing what is right. He's thrown into the pit. And he's gone from bad to worse. Poor Joseph. No, 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 no. He would say, "Don't you blame yourselves, brothers, for sending me here. It was God who sent me here to save you. If I hadn't come, we would have perished with hunger." And it didn't do him much harm either. Joseph becomes the man he needs to become. He matures. And he becomes a type of Christ, if you'll start looking at the comparisons. But we don't have time for that. Hezekiah, good man, is told by the prophet in 2 Kings 20, "Get your house in order, you're going to die." He turns his face to the wall and he weeps, "God, have I not been your faithful servant all these years? Why is this happening to me? I'm going to Hades, my work unfinished." Isaiah, God says, "Go back and tell me it's 15 more years." I sadly say that many times people think more of the quantity of their years than they do the quality. It was after his recovery from his boil that the ambassadors from Babylon come. And he shows them all his treasures. "Yeah, God restored me. He's given me all these things." And Isaiah has to take him down a few notches. And he says, "You know, that's like letting the fox in the hen house. They're going to come back and they're going to take your sons into captivity." And Hezekiah says, "Well, at least they're not coming in my day. I'm grateful for that much." Long life is not necessarily what we're after. It's quality of life. Sometimes I've seen occasions where people live and go astray. When if they could have died and be faithful to God, they would have gone into righteousness. And then there's Paul, Philippians 3. Paul, the fascinating man who is as mature as any man I know in Scripture and his following of Christ, he gives a list of his trash he had to throw out. He had a lot of trash in his life. Saul of Tarsus did. He had a lot of confidence in the flesh. Verse 4, he had to throw that out. No more confidence in the flesh. He was circumcised the eighth day. Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, Pharisee. Zeal was so great. He was persecuting the church. He wanted to rid the world of any mention of Christ. He hated him more than anyone, I suppose. The righteousness in the law, oh, that made him blameless. But he says, "What gain I had in these, I counted loss for Christ." He's like they were on the ship going to Rome. Start jettisoning the ship. Doesn't matter what it is. You got grain on here, throw it out. Dead men don't eat grain anyway. Throw it out. If it's heavy, get rid of it. "What things were gained to me, these I counted loss for Christ." And then in verse 8, "Then indeed I also count all things lost for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish." Count them as rubbish that I may gain Christ. He says, "I got rid of everything." I don't know how you are, but I can't stand to watch the hoarders on TV. You know who hoarders are. It's depressing. So I don't watch those. Paul was a hoarder. As Saul of Tarsus, he was gathering all these human credentials, all this human power, all this human reliance upon himself. Blameless according to the law. Great reputation among the Jews. And he says, when I found who Christ really is, I quit hoarding. I got rid of everything that I might hold that one treasure. I found that one pearl of great price. Christ Jesus, and I count everything else. Rubbish here is a polite word for stinking garbage. Everything else is stinking garbage compared to Christ. Now, when we think about these things, we see the value, not of gaining, but of losing in this world. Isn't that what Matthew 16 says? He who gains is the one who loses, and he who loses is the one who gains. There's a little girl. It was in the New York Times in 2012. I want to say she lives in New York. Was born without the ability to feel pain. Ashlyn Blocker is her name. If you want to look her up. When her teeth came in, she almost bit her tongue off. She felt no pain. When she was a little toddler, she broke her ankle and ran around on that broken ankle for 2 days before the parents realized what she had done. And once when she was cooking something, she had something fall in this pot of hot boiling water. She stuck her hand in it to get it out and felt no pain. The mother saw what she'd done and came running. And that's been the story of that mother, poor mother's life. Because if you have a child who feels no pain, imagine having to watch that child to keep her away from things that common sense otherwise and the ability to feel pain would have prevented. Her doctor, a specialist, calls this congenital insensitivity. It's very rare, but it does happen. Congenital insensitivity is a curse, not a blessing. You think, how great if you never feel any pain. No. Her doctor said, he said these words. He said, pain is a blessing. And she was born without it. One little girl in England, born with the same congenital insensitivity, was crawling into a hot stove and felt absolutely no pain. One little boy who had it, at his, I think his 7th birthday, was up. He climbed up on a roof to jump off to entertain his friends. He jumped down, felt no pain. Next day he died from internal bleeding. Just couldn't feel anything going on in there. Pain is a great blessing, isn't it? Oh, yes. If it turns us to God. The origin of pain, and I'll be quick with this. Most people understand about everything there is to know about pain. They say, why did God do this to me? You ever heard that? Something goes wrong, they say, what have I done to make God punish me this way? I loved him too much, so God took him. Oh, I don't know how many times I've heard this of people. And you'll hear someone say, well, God loved him so much, he wanted him. So God just killed your child or whoever, and he took him to be with him because he loved him that much. I guess he didn't love us that much. What are we thinking when we say these things? Where does the Bible ever teach these concepts? I don't know. You certainly can't use Elijah and Enoch because they didn't die. And this is talking about death. So where does it say anything like this? I don't know. The painful truth is, Genesis 3, man, not God, is the one who brought pain, death, and suffering. And that's in Genesis 3. In Luke 13, we've already seen. These people who are standing in a certain place and that Tower of Siloam falls down and kills these 18 men. Jesus says, do you think those are the worst sinners around? They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Accidents do happen. Be careful. Don't stand around towers. They don't have a good foundation. In John 9, this man born blind. The disciples say, now which one is the sinner? Is it this man or is it his parents? And Jesus said, neither one of them. He's not going through this because of some sin. And it's the same way with Job. If we assign any blame, put it on Satan. Satan said, Job serves you just because of what he can get out of you. There's no sincerity on his part. You butter his bread. But you let me take away that buttering and he'll curse you to your face. And God says, you can take his possessions, but don't hurt him physically. After it was all over, the smoke settled, he lost even his children. And he did not curse God. And then Satan comes again. God says, see what I told you? And God rubs the salt in Satan's eyes and he never likes that. And so he said, well, you didn't let me do enough. You let me touch his body. Let me give him physical pain and he'll curse you to your face. God says, you can touch his body, but you don't kill him. He did. And Job said some things he shouldn't. And he apologized for those, but he never cursed God and died like Mrs. Job told him to do. And Satan never came back and said, "I was wrong, Job, I'm sorry. I was wrong, God, I misled everyone and I falsely accused you." No, Satan doesn't apologize, he just looks for the next victim. But you'll notice in 2 Corinthians 12, when Paul talks about his thorn in the flesh, he calls it a messenger of Satan to afflict me, and yet Paul's going to use it for good in service to God. Or you can blame yourself by saying, this is something I do. Abimelech is an evil man, son of Gideon. He's standing under a tower, and this woman, bless her heart, she takes a huge rock and lets it go, and it falls on his head and kills it. And so he calls for his armor bearer, and he says, "Would you stick that sword in me and kill me so it won't be said that a woman did it," as if that mattered at a time like this. This is a perverted man, and he's suffering because of choices he made. He didn't have to get into this line of work. Terrorism doesn't pay. And you see Absalom, who ends up trying a coup attempt against his own father, David. And he ends up hanging by a tree with the very part of his body that had been so glorified, his hair. Joab comes and tosses those darts in him. Those men whack him to pieces and they put him in his tomb and pile rocks on him, and that's the end of Absalom. If we want to blame someone for the pain we suffer, much of the time we need to look in the mirror. C.S. Lewis made it like this. He said, "Pain is not good in itself. What is good in any painful experience is for the sufferer, person who's going through it, his submission to the will of God. And for the spectators, the compassion aroused and the acts of mercy to which it leads." Which leads me to say these four things in conclusion. Pain will accompany us for the rest of our time on earth. Now, I know you were hoping I would say, well, pain is almost out of style, and in another couple of years we won't see it. But that's not going to happen. I don't have such authority. Francis Thompson wrote these words, "Nothing begins and nothing ends that is not paid with moan." M-O-A-N. You know, moan. "For we're born in others' pain, and we perish in our own. We come into this world, and someone else is suffering. We leave this world, and we suffer. From beginning to end, there's pain, and all the way through, it's scattered." Number two, we can use it for our spiritual advantage. Dick Vermeil, who had been coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, was known as a hard taskmaster. He worked his men, his players went through double and triple practices, and he came down hard on them, and they thought, "He's killing us. Who can take this?" By the time he got them worked into shape, they go to the Super Bowl. This same man who they thought was killing them wrote these words. He said, "The first principle for success is make sure people know you care about them." What? This slave-driving killer cares about me? Yes. What does he say? People care about those who care about them. How do we reconcile his pain with his principle? He knew these men wanted more than anything else to go to the Super Bowl. In order to accomplish that, they're going to have to hurt. And if they'll hurt on their own, their opponent can't do as much to them. Sergeant World War II, one of the men who's raising the flag at Iwo Jima, the famous photo. Sergeant, those guys around him. He promised them, he said, "I know I'm working you hard. I'm making it very difficult for you, but I'm so hard on you because I'm trying to give you the equipment you need to be able to come back to your mamas when it's over." That was his purpose. He had an overarching purpose that helped them see through the pain for the gain that can be theirs, even though it hurt them. I look at all this and I see God saying the same things. 1 Corinthians 9:27, "I buffet my body. I beat myself black and blue," Paul said, "that I might win that prize. Lest the enemies, after I preach to others, I myself should become a castaway," or reprobate, or unqualified, or worthless. Number three, the present pain should teach us to avoid eternal pain. Matthew 25:46. "If we can hurt so much here, I don't want to hurt in hell." I knew an old man right now. He's a gospel preacher whose neighbor had a pan on her stove that had oil in it. It burst into flame. She screamed. He ran into the house and saw it, grabbed the pan, was walking out, and when she opened the door, it caused a draft, and that stuff came on his arms. Oh, he said, "I have hurt like I never thought possible. he would be lying there waiting for them to take him to the burn unit where they're going to scrape him on those. I won't go any further. Let me just say, he says, I don't care what it takes. I am determined never to go to hell. Where'd he get that? Pain helped him learn a lesson. And number four, pain should bring us closer to God. I read about this man who saw his cat with a little wren. He ran over to it. He plied apart the cat's claws and grabbed the wren. And though that wren had a broken wing, it was struggling with all of its might to get out of its Savior's hand. It didn't trust him. He said, shortly thereafter, my daughter, I had to take to the pediatrician. She had strep throat. And the doctor wanted to give her a shot. When the doctor came at her with a needle, he said, she grabbed my neck and squeezed and I thought I couldn't breathe, had her legs wrapped around me, and all the while she was saying, no, Daddy, no, Daddy, no, Daddy. And he said, isn't it interesting? The bird tries to get away, but the child tries to get closer. And let us in our suffering not be like a wren who tries to go away from God, as some have done, but rather like a child who draws closer to God because we trust Him. We don't understand why this shot. We know it hurts. But pain should make us more like a child than it does a wounded bird. Thank you for your excellent attention once again. It could be that someone in this very audience has never taken seriously what God has said in His Word. We would not close this assembly without giving you the opportunity to express to this entire group your faith in Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, and having repented of your sins to be buried with Him in baptism and rise and walk through a new life, in a brand new kind of life, where you will trust God no matter what happens in view of what He's promised. If you've done this and it turned aside, come back to Him, and if there's anything you need to do to make that known publicly, let's respond now as together we stand and sing.